Today, could Trump's perfect phone call lead to his impeachment? And it's the beginning of Black History Month, but why do we need it? Last Wednesday, Lauren Gambino, The Guardian's US political correspondent, was on Capitol Hill waiting for an important announcement from the House Speaker.
Nancy Pelosi had teased an announcement in the morning, and it felt like we were moving towards impeachment.
The actions taken to date by the president have seriously violated the Constitution.
All the speculation concluded with Nancy Pelosi's formal announcement to the American people that Congress, under her leadership, was going to launch formal impeachment inquiry against Donald Trump.
Therefore, today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
Impeachment is such a rarity in American history. It's only happened four times, three times in modern history. You know, I think when you look back, whatever happens, whether he is ultimately impeached by the House or not, I think you'll see that as a moment in history. And, you know, you could feel the weight of the moment.
This moment in history came about because of a single phone call between Donald Trump and the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
From Russia, if you're listening, to Ukraine, take out Joe Biden for me, will ya? Donald Trump making clear that he can't win the presidency without foreign interference and doesn't have any interest in trying.
This could be the undoing of Donald Trump, but it might have gone unnoticed were it not for the actions of an intelligence official who decided to blow the whistle and complain about the call. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, could this impeachment inquiry end Donald Trump's presidency? This all began with a phone call Donald Trump made in July to the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. Now, he's only been elected for a few months, and he's really inexperienced. He used to be a stand-up comedian.
Now, a total political outsider, famous for playing a president in a TV drama, will swap acting for the real thing after winning Ukraine's presidential election.
So Trump calls him, and bearing in mind that up to this point he'd been withholding aid to Ukraine before this call, and he asks Zelensky for a favour. What was it?
So he asks the president of Ukraine to start an investigation into Joe Biden and his family.
Going on to then say, I would like a favor, the president saying there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great.
The investigation the president's referring to dates back to when Joe Biden was vice president and his son Hunter was working for a Ukrainian energy company.
Biden on page four, he says there's a lot of talk about Biden and his son, and a lot of people want to find out if Biden stopped the prosecution of a company tied to his son.
Here in the U.S., reporters have looked into this connection. We have not been able to substantiate anything in these claims. But nonetheless, he wants Ukrainian prosecutors to start an investigation.
I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary call, isn't it? And it's a pretty extraordinary request to make of another leader.
It's absolutely extraordinary.
This call between Trump and Zelensky happened in July. But how did this information, how the information about that call, make it into the public domain a couple of weeks ago?
So Congress had been alerted to a whistleblower complaint from the intelligence community. They didn't have access to the complaint, and eventually the complaint was turned over to Congress, and the complaint was released to the public.
Good evening, and thank you so much for joining us. Tonight, an explosive allegation by a government whistleblower.
And this complaint made by that intelligence official was a really interesting document. Like, it was very thorough, and whoever had written it had clearly put a lot of thought into it. What did it tell us about what the president had done?
In the complaint, the whistleblower says that Donald Trump is soliciting a foreign leader to interfere in the U.S. election. The whistleblower says that White House aides, quote unquote, locked down this transcript and put it on a server that was meant for confidential calls. The complaint makes clear that he doesn't believe this should have been put on that server. This should have been circulated like other calls because there wasn't anything specifically of national security concern in the call. So effectively what he is arguing in this complaint is that this was done to protect the president's wrongdoing. And then he opens up a completely new line of inquiry by suggesting that there are other calls that this has been done to conceal.
The complaint reports a, quote, repeated abuse of an electronic record system designed to store classified, sensitive national security information. This is a cover-up.
This goes beyond, doesn't it? You know, this implication that White House staff are essentially, you know, allegedly covering up calls that the president is making. That's incredible.
It's now not just the crime, but also the cover-up. What's extraordinary is that we just finished the special counsel inquiry into Russian interference in the U.S. election, and to then have a complaint alleging that the president is trying to do just that after he narrowly escaped impeachment just months ago. It's incredible that Trump is so brazen.
I think, you know, we use the word unbelievable a lot in this story because it really is. And it's also incredibly complicated in many ways. And one of the other things that we learned from this whistleblower complaint is that this is more than just a phone call between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky. It also involves Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. What's his role in this story?
Rudy Giuliani plays an interesting role. He's the personal lawyer to Donald Trump. And in that capacity, he has tried and pushed Ukraine to start investigating.
It doesn't make any sense in this case, Chris. It's highly unusual that the State Department or any other department or agency would turn to a private citizen, especially Rudy Giuliani, who, of course, is no longer just the former mayor of New York City. He's also President Trump's personal attorney.
I think he has initiated several calls with Ukrainian leaders, and he's just at the center of pushing this theory, and now he's sort of gone rogue and has started to sort of conduct this shadow foreign policy mission, again, about Donald Trump's chief political rival at this stage.
But on Sunday, Giuliani appeared on ABC News and denied that he had been asked by Trump to investigate Joe Biden.
Not investigating Joe Biden. I fell upon Joe Biden in investigating how the Ukrainians were conspiring with the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Lauren, in terms of scandals that Trump has become embroiled in, how serious is this one, do you think?
This one is extraordinarily serious. Democrats have been pretty cautious to go down this route, and Nancy Pelosi set the bar fairly high. She didn't want to do this until they thought they had a strong case. And that didn't happen all through the special counsel's investigation, which again looked at whether the Trump campaign in 2016 had colluded with Russia to help its campaign, which was a pretty extraordinary allegation at the time. But now that Donald Trump is president, the allegation is that he's using his office as president to pressure a country that really depends on U.S. aid. And this is just extraordinary. You don't invite foreign leaders to interfere in the U.S. election, and you don't sort of use your office to bully other countries.
Ukraine values its relationship with America. Since the country's 2014 revolution, America has been a key ally, providing crucial financial and military aid to them. Andrew Roth is The Guardian's Moscow correspondent, and last week was reporting on this story from Kiev. Let's go to the point where this story kind of begins. It all centres around Hunter Biden, who is the son of former Vice President Joe Biden. What has his involvement been in Ukraine?
In 2014, after the revolution in Ukraine, there's a huge anti-corruption movement and a lot of companies change hands. And there's a sense that there's a lot of business to be done in Ukraine with the new government and new political forces coming in. It's at this time that a company that deals in natural gas called Burisma hires Hunter Biden.
And a son of the U.S. vice president has joined the board of directors of Ukraine's largest private gas producer. Hunter Biden now leads the company's legal unit
and puts him onto the board of directors of the company. And they're reportedly paying him something like $50,000 each month. At this point, when Hunter Biden joins the company in 2014, Burisma, it's already been put under a lot of suspicion in terms of its business practices, in terms of possibly paying bribes. I mean, this was a company that already had a lot of questions about how clean its business was, and that was an additional reason why Biden's sort of involvement with the Ukrainian natural gas company, which wasn't a business he had experience in, also started to raise a lot of questions. What was he doing on the board of directors, and what was his role exactly supposed to be? So we fast forward 2 years, and Hunter Biden's father, Joe Biden, is naturally the vice president of the United States. And he comes into conflict with the prosecutor general of Ukraine, Viktor Shokin. He's largely seen here as corrupt or at least ineffective. At the same time, there had been investigations that had been opened into Burisma as well. And it was at that point, with prodding from the United States, that, and from Joe Biden in particular, who was running the relationship with Ukraine, that prosecutor general is forced out.
I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Well, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid.
And he's replaced later that year. Donald Trump and some others say that Biden intervened in a possible investigation into his son's business dealings by pushing out the prosecutor general.
It's worth saying that this isn't just prodding from the US or from Joe Biden. Other Western countries wanted Shokin to be removed. So is there any weight to allegations that Biden did this just to help out his son Hunter?
The idea that that was the main motivation for pushing out Shokin seems largely unfounded, or at least not backed up by evidence.
How has Volodymyr Zelensky responded to the story?
He said very little about it, and I think that's because his administration has made clear that they're trying to stay neutral in this case. You know, Zelensky has mainly said that he tried to have a good telephone conversation with Donald Trump, that nothing improper was said. And he's also said that he didn't expect his side of the conversation to be released. I mean, you could see the kind of reaction on his face during the press conference with Donald Trump.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to me to be here. And it's better to be on TV than by phone.
Yeah.
Thank you. And Mr. President, thank you very much. And I'm not
with him, kind of staring with just this dead look in his eyes as he's kind of thinking about all the ramifications of what had happened in the last day.
Yeah, he looked like a really small boy who was like kind of sat on the naughty step and was having to let Donald Trump, you know, speak for him in a way.
That nobody pushed it. Pushed me, yes.
In other words, no pressure.
Silently exasperated. I mean, you had to feel for him a little bit, even though, you know, he knows what he's doing and knew what was in the telephone call. You still kind of felt for him in that moment. I think he's lucky that this happened so early in his term, when he's still so popular and when people haven't really become discouraged yet with what's happening in Ukraine.
And you've been in Ukraine for the past few days, gauging response to all of this. Is this front page news there? What are people saying?
You know, it's funny. I think, you know, generally it's not front page news here, which is surprising considering it involves, you know, a popular president with a big media presence.
Yeah, it would feel like a pretty big story.
It does seem like a pretty big story. And obviously, you know, it's in the news. But Ukrainians mainly think about domestic news, like Americans. In small circles, in political circles, and in civil society circles, though, I mean, this is huge news. It's shockwave news. I think that the main reason for that is that the United States has been looked to as a model for the way that Ukraine should reform itself for, you know, the last 5 years or for even longer. And for a long time, Ukrainians have been told that their country has a big corruption problem. So many Ukrainians who are in those circles see this as almost a case when the corruption is flowing the other way from the United States toward Ukraine. For a lot of them, the United States has been seen as, you know, a sort of role model of how Ukraine is supposed to develop itself.
Andrew, thank you very much. Lauren, last week, the acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph Maguire, who's only been in the job for a few weeks, like this is really throwing him in at the deep end at the start of a new job, he testified before Congress. And what did he say during that session that you thought was significant?
He said a couple things. First, as you point out, he wanted to remind them that he has only been on this job a couple weeks. And he did say, you know, I don't think I would have taken this job if I knew what I was stepping into.
I wouldn't have taken the job if I did. No, sir.
You know, he said multiple times this was unprecedented. At some point, he made a robust defense of what the whistleblower did. He said, I think he or she did do what they believed was right and was acting in good conscience.
Lauren, how has Trump been reacting to all of this?
As you would imagine, he's taken this, you know, calmly, rationally. No.
Not tweeted at all.
He is furious. And you can tell the White House was shocked by this turn of events. It happened so quickly. If you had called me 2 weeks ago, I would have said impeachment. No way. Chances are zero. You're asking the wrong questions. It happened so fast and so furiously. And incredibly, this is all unfolding last week while Donald Trump is in New York at the United Nations General Assembly.
It's the single greatest witch hunt in American history, probably in history, but in American history.
And Trump didn't stop there. The following day, the LA Times published a recording of him speaking at a private event with US diplomatic officials in New York, where he again attacked the whistleblower.
But basically, that person never saw the report, never saw the call.
He was recorded as saying that we used to handle spies a little differently.
You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? The spies and treason. We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
The implication is that people convicted of treason were put to death.
How could this play out? Democrats are moving to impeach Donald Trump. Can you just explain to me how that could work in practice?
So Democrats have said they want to go forward with this very quickly. They'll gather all of this information. They'll put together a case. They'll present the case to their caucus and they will decide, you know, is this enough to formally impeach the president? If they decide yes, then you have a vote on the House floor whether President of the United States is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, and every member of the House of Representatives will have to take a vote. If it passes, it goes to the Senate, where you have a trial. The Senate is controlled by Republicans, so consensus is Trump would be acquitted. But I think you're already seeing it won't be an easy vote for many.
So is this very risky for the Democrats? Could this plan backfire?
I think it's risky for everybody. It's risky for the Democrats because we're in an extraordinarily polarized time. Republicans and Democrats are so fiercely divided. It's unclear how many minds they can actually change by presenting this case to the public. And therefore, if you don't get enough public buy-in, this could hurt them in 2020. There could be significant backlash from the population if they don't believe that this impeachment inquiry was warranted. So, but I also think it's risky for Republicans. These are the kind of votes that stay with you long after Donald Trump will be in office. So I think there's a lot of pressure on them to think about, you know, how history will record their vote, especially if more comes out. I think it puts Republicans in a harder position than maybe we initially thought.
Lauren, how much do people in America care about this?
That's what's going to make the difference, actually. Before Democrats launched their impeachment inquiry, support for this was quite low. There's been a few polls that showed that's changing, especially among Democrats. I think the challenge for Democrats is going to be to explain why they believe it's a national security risk and why they believe that Trump has, quote unquote, violated his oath of office and is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the bar for a president to be impeached.
Lauren, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can read more of Lauren's reporting at the Guardian website. Coming up, how the Guardian will be covering Black History Month.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together, we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Now, today marks the beginning of Black History Month, a time to celebrate the contributions that Black Britons have made to UK society and to remember a past that many might choose to forget. Joseph Harker is The Guardian's Deputy Opinion Editor.
When I first started out as a reporter in 1987, one of the very first stories I covered was the launch of the first Black History Month in Britain. It was an era of riots and unrest in the streets and of the most vicious racist messages and front pages that were being plastered almost daily in the national newspapers. And the thinking behind the first Black History Month was that we are getting so much negative coverage about black people that we need to show exactly what we've done and a more positive side and show why we are here and why we have a history that we can be proud of. Many people think black people didn't have a presence in this country until the Empire Windrush in 1948. In fact, black people's presence in this country goes back to the 2nd century and the Roman Emperor Septimius Severus, who actually got as far as Scotland in propping up the Roman Empire. If you believe what you mostly read about black people, it's as if we have contributed nothing to history. We've brought no science, no literature, and all our roles began as slaves, but we have done an awful lot more than that. Often there's a US focus on black history. You know, we know the entertainers, politicians. That can leave us thinking that black history is all about what went on in the States, whereas black history in Britain is about what happened in this country, and it's also about what happened in the British Empire, in the British colonies, which is, after all, why we have a strong black presence in this country. I think it's important that black people understand their presence here in the UK, but I think it's also very important that white people understand black people's presence in the UK. And it can't just be the kind of event that takes place only in black schools or only in towns with a large black population. You know, in some of the whitest areas of the country, it's important that they also know that Britain's history is not exclusively white and that other races have made a massive contribution to who Britain is, to what Britain is. For this month, we are going to commit every day to publish a person of colour in the newspaper opinion pages. That's important because we need to hear minority voices shaping the general debate. This is our way to sort of set aside one month as a start to make a change, and in the hope that this won't just be a month, it will carry on after that as well.
That was Joseph Harker. My thanks to him, Lauren Gambino and Andrew Roth. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.